Your KQED traffic update starts with the continuing trouble on the peninsula. Here's Julie Depesch.
Hey, I do have a better location now. That vehicle fire is southbound 101 before Highway 85. Got fire crews blocking the two left lanes. Traffic stopped all the way back to Willow. A new trouble in Berkeley. A couple of cars got into it westbound 80 before Ashby. They're on the shoulder, but it's slow back to Gilman. A heads up in Vacaville, eastbound 80 on the off-ramp to Alicia Town Road. It's a stalled SUV blocking that off-ramp. Julie Depesch for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from UCSF Health, collaborating with Marin Health to deliver exceptional orthopedic care in the North Bay, leading specialists in arthritis, joint replacement, spine, hand, elbow, and more. UCSFHealth.org/Marin Health. I'm Michelle Hennigan, and this is KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland, Sacramento. It's 5 o'clock.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi appears to have won a third term.
But this time he'll have to share power with coalition partners who may not necessarily share his agenda.
Today is Tuesday, June 4th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, President Biden rolls out new measures to restrict the number of migrants able to cross the southern border.
I've come here today to do what the Republicans in Congress refuse to do. Take the necessary steps to secure our border.
In Ukraine, a music festival opens to a full house even as air raid sirens and explosions boom outside.
And the new movie Ezra stars an actor with autism playing an autistic character.
When we see portrayals like this on film, those things really change the way we're treated in real life. It's important to get these things right.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Biden signed an executive order today that will effectively shut down the U.S.-Mexico border tonight. As Texas Public Radio's Pablo De La Rosa reports, the new rule sharply limits requests for asylum from migrants entering at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Under the new rules, the border will temporarily close to asylum seekers crossing between lawful ports of entry when the daily average goes above 2,500. Danny Marrero-High is deputy director at LUPE, an advocacy organization that works directly with migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border.
The solutions that they're proposing is trying to influence what's going to happen at the ballot in November, and that's just not the way to address a humanitarian issue like immigration.
Senior officials said individuals who cross without authorization during the shutdown will become ineligible for asylum. I'm Pablo De La Rosa in McAllen.
President Biden is departing for France at this hour. As NPR's Tamara Keith explains, he'll join an international commemoration of D-Day, the Allied invasion that hastened the end of World War II.
When some 70,000 U.S. troops joined allies from the U.K. and Canada and landed on the beaches of Normandy, the sacrifices were immense, but it marked a turning point in World War II. Now, 80 years later, President Biden will join other leaders in marking the anniversary. John Kirby is a White House spokesman.
He will take full advantage of the opportunity to talk about the moment we're living in, the importance of democracies working together on behalf of their peoples, but also the importance of American leadership.
This comes as, once again, a land war rages on the European continent with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Paris.
Testifying on Capitol Hill today, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland called attacks on the Justice Department unprecedented and pushed back against some Republican lawmakers. Testifying before the House Judiciary Committee, Garland also denounced attacks on the department by former President Trump.
I will not be intimidated, and the Justice Department will not be intimidated. We will continue to do our jobs free from political influence, and we will not back down from defending democracy.
Some House Republicans have betrayed charges against Trump, including his recent felony conviction for falsifying business records as part of an organized effort by Democrats at the federal level. There have also been GOP attempts to hold Garland in contempt for the Biden administration's refusal to hand over audio of President Biden's interview with special counsel Robert Hur. The number of help wanted signs being put up by employers hit its lowest level in 3 years in April, though still at a historically high mark, even amid signs higher interest rates have slowed the economy. The Labor Department reported today employers posted 8.1 million vacancies in April, down from 8.4 million in March. This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. The latest batch of votes in Berkeley's election for the vacant city council seat in District 4 show Igor Tregub ahead with 51% and Ruben Hernandez Story with 49%. All other candidates have been eliminated in the ranked choice voting process. Although the figures aren't official and there may still be some ballots left to count, Tregub has declared victory. In a statement, he thanked supporters and opponents and said, quote, "Elections come and go. Community is what we build in between." The special election was called after Kate Harrison abruptly resigned her seat in January. A day after a fire ripped through an affordable housing complex under construction near Redwood City, local leaders are vowing to rebuild. KQED's Vanessa Roncagno reports.
San Mateo County needs to build more than 1,200 units of affordable housing in the next few years to meet the expected demand. The 179 apartments in the destroyed building would have helped close that gap. Board of Supervisors President Warren Slocum represents the district where the complex is located. He says the project was 10 years in the making.
It's just a devastating loss in terms of affordable units. We're all committed to rebuilding. We're not just going to walk away from it.
Slocum says insurance should cover much of the cost of rebuilding, and the county will likely seek state and federal funds to make up the difference. I'm Vanessa Rancagno, KQED News.
There's more state and local news online at kqed.org. I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support for NPR comes from USPS, dedicated to providing businesses with shipping options, working to help businesses avoid shipping challenges with USPS Ground Advantage. Learn more at usps.com/advantage and from the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED comes from Save the Bay, imagining a Bay Area where people and wildlife thrive. This future is possible. Turn the tide and rise to the climate challenge. More at SaveSFBayNow.org. Current temperature right now in San Francisco is 78 degrees. In San Jose, it's 88. The Bay Area hotspot is Antioch at 96 degrees right now. The current temperature in Sacramento is 102. The heat wave will continue through Thursday, according to the National Weather Service. This is KQED.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. After 6 weeks of voting, in which more than 640 million people cast their ballots, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has claimed victory. The election took place amid a deadly heat wave, and it puts Modi on track to lead the world's most populous nation for the third time. But voters appear to have clipped his wings, as NPR's Dia Hadid reports from New Delhi.
Early morning, outside the headquarters of the ruling BJP party, a man waves devotional candles before a life-size cardboard cutout of the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. Modi, we worship you, he chants. The mood, more prayer than party. Modi began these elections vowing to win a supermajority. Critics say he enjoyed a tilted playing field. Much of Indian media cheered him on. Law enforcement agencies froze the accounts of the main opposition Congress party, and they detained one of his main rivals on allegations of kickbacks. Critics say India's Election Commission largely ignored violations of campaigning rules by the Prime Minister, including a ban on inciting communal hatred when at a rally he described India's Muslim minority as infiltrators. Yet as poll workers tallied the results, it was clear the mood had shifted. Modi's party won the largest number of seats in Parliament, but not a simple majority, and not the supermajority he promised. But it was still a victory. Before supporters at the BJP headquarters, he says, on this auspicious day, the NDA will form government for the third time. The NDA is a reference to the coalition that Modi leads, but he's never had to rely on coalition partners before, because in the past two elections, his party won outright. Not anymore.
He's going to have a fairly undignified few years in the chair.
Kapil Komaredi writes on Indian politics, including for The New Yorker. Kamareddy says Modi has never had to appease a coalition. He's always projected himself as governing alone, a distant but loving father of the nation. But after losing so many seats...
That is in tatters now.
And Kamareddy says the BJP may now question Modi's authority to govern. As the day stretched on, a marching band entertained the crowd. The mood picked up. Nishant Singh served cups of rose-flavoured buttermilk to supporters. In broken English, he says, incumbency is hard.
It is a very difficult for run a party. Then he gives the all workers to give that.
And he adds, Modi made history by winning three consecutive terms. The only other Indian leader to have done that was the founder of modern India, Jawaharlal Nehru. On the road, a group of Muslim BJP supporters give celebratory treats to motorists and get scolded by traffic police.
My name is Irfan Mirza.
Not many Muslims support the BJP, but Irfan Mirza says he's celebrating another 5 years of Modi.
Feel very proudly, feel very happily.
But he also seems relieved that the party's majority was curbed. He says the BJP tried to incite against Muslims to whip up their Hindu nationalist base to vote for them. It was an election tactic, he says, and it didn't work. Now the party can focus on what he says is a winning strategy, India's development. As he speaks, it starts to rain, breaking an extreme heat wave that's gripped Delhi for weeks. He says it's a good sign. Dear Hadid, NPR News, New Delhi.
A political revolution is happening in New Jersey today. Democratic primary voters will receive newly designed ballots meant to break the state's long-running political machine. It's the result of a successful legal challenge by Democratic Congressman and Senate candidate Andy Kim, who took on that machine and won. NPR political correspondent Susan Davis reports on how Kim was the right candidate at the right time.
Corruption is so ingrained in New Jersey politics that a May 2023 poll showed as many as 80% of its residents believed its politicians were corrupt. And that was 4 months before Democratic Senator Bob Menendez was indicted for the second time on corruption charges.
I didn't get a single minute of sleep that night. You know, I really felt like I had to do something and really show people that, you know, when there's these problems in our politics that there are people who want to step up and try to fix it.
That's three-term Congressman Andy Kim. He was the first New Jersey Democrat to call for Menendez to resign after his indictment last September. Kim then hastily gathered his political advisors and asked them, what if he ran for Senate instead?
Many of them said, oh, well, look, we can build out a six-week roadmap here. We can have a launch video. We can have a website and a press plan. And I remember just telling them on the phone, like, what would you say if I launched in 3 hours from now?
And he did just that, announcing his Senate bid with a tweet. But New Jersey's Democratic political machine had other plans for the seat. Tammy Murphy, a newcomer but also the wife of Democratic Governor Phil Murphy, jumped into the race weeks later. Her candidacy added a dose of high-profile political nepotism to a primary already shaped by corruption as Menendez refused to drop out. As Murphy was winning endorsements from Kim's fellow Democratic congressman, Kim's campaign was gaining steam on the ground with voters.
I was often 20 points up in the polls, but I was still referred to as the underdog of the race because of this structural problem.
That structural problem is known as the line. Unlike every other state, which lists candidates on ballots by the office they're running for, New Jersey's primary ballots are organized around a slate of candidates endorsed by party leaders that are then presented to voters as a line of names together. Other candidates are placed in columns or rows further away in a place critics refer to as ballot Siberia. One such critic, Julia Sass Rubin, an associate dean at Rutgers University, says the line system, in place since roughly the 1940s, has been extraordinarily successful at electing the preferred candidates of both Democratic and Republican Party bosses.
It provides a double-digit advantage to candidates consistently over a period of 20 years, I found.
In February, Kim filed a lawsuit challenging that ballot design. In March, Murphy surprisingly dropped out of the Senate race after her campaign lagged as Kim scored upset victories in local Democratic county conventions. And then in April, Kim won in court. A federal appeals court upheld a preliminary injunction that bars the use of the line balloting system in today's Democratic primary. Professor Rubin was an expert witness in the case, and she described its impact this way.
It's an absolute earthquake for the state because the county line has allowed a handful of people, really a handful of men, to make all the decisions for the state. If you can control who gets elected to political office, you can control everything.
In a matter of weeks, Kim went from long shot to presumptive nominee, who is now well positioned to win in November. Menendez does plan to run as an independent, but New Jersey hasn't elected a Republican to the Senate in over 50 years. Kim's successful campaign to beat the old system has earned him begrudging respect from some party elders who long supported it, like Congressman Bill Pascrell, who's served in Jersey politics for about as long as the 41-year-old Kim has been alive.
This is the segue. This is how we get to the next generation. It is what it is. I'm not going to cry over it.
In many ways, Rubin says, Kim was the right candidate at the right political moment.
He definitely had the right framing for people to believe that he is a reformer, and he was willing to take that risk and go up against the system.
Part of that framing comes from a photograph of Kim that went viral after rioters trashed the Capitol on January 6th. It shows the congressman down on his hands and knees in the rotunda picking up trash. He says he received thousands of letters from Americans moved by that show of decency.
After January 6th, people asked me, are you going to continue to be in politics? Are you going to do this? And I said, yes, I'm actually going to now dedicate my life to trying to solve and address one singular question, which is, how do we heal this country?
Kim admits he doesn't really know all the answers to that question. But if elected to the Senate this November, it won't involve towing the party line. Susan Davis, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli troops withdrew from the Jabalia refugee camp in North Gaza last week. The three-week offensive forced tens of thousands of Palestinians to flee. As Hadil El-Shalchi reports, some are now returning to see what's become of their homes. And a warning, this story includes graphic descriptions of the aftermath of war.
Amin Abed is from Jabalia, a place once densely populated and that saw some of the fiercest fighting during the war. He says the attacks were intensely horrific, with shelling, bombs, and snipers. So Abed packed up his family and fled west. And after weeks of displacement, it was time to go back home to Jabalia last week. I walked on foot half of the way home, he says, then I found a donkey cart and rode it the rest of the way. But Abed didn't find much there. The scene was frightening, he says. My house was rubble, the doors and windows blown out, and Abed says the neighborhood was terrifying. The corpses he saw on the street were charred, he says, being eaten by dogs. I personally had to collect the remains of my uncle and cousin in a bag, he says. Their bodies were burned by the sun. The Israeli military is expanding its operations across Gaza, and Palestinians say they feel like nowhere is safe. It was a miracle we were able to escape, Abed says. The Israeli military went back to Jabalia 4 months after originally withdrawing. It said Hamas had regrouped there. In that same mission, the military said that it had recovered the bodies of 7 hostages taken by Hamas on October 7th. With more than one operation in Jabalia so far, Abed says who knows if there won't be another. Of course we're afraid of another attack, he says. Israeli military believes that a good Palestinian is a dead Palestinian. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Ramallah.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
KQED traffic at 518 starts with that fire in Mountain View. Here's Julie Deppish.
And that is a minivan that's on fire south 101 before Highway 85. Now, fire crews have the two left lanes taken away and a big backup to Willow Road. Got a brush fire in San Jose. They've shut down the Capitol Expressway on-ramp to northbound 101. And over in Cupertino, south 280 before Wolf Road. Wreck there in the second lane for the left and delays back to Highway 85. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Style Bath and Kitchen. providing design knowledge on how to pick the right kitchen faucet, cabinets, bathroom, shower, or bathtub, and more in their new video series, available on their website by searching Style Bath and Kitchen online. And from TheaterWorks Silicon Valley, presenting Being Alive, a Sondheim celebration, a world premiere tribute to the composer of Into the Woods, Sweeney Todd, Company, and more, June 5th to 30th in Mountain View, TheaterWorks.org.
Coming up tomorrow on Forum with guest host Leslie McClurg, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie were as much a part of American culture as Coca-Cola and Mickey Mouse, says Larry Tye, author of a new biography of the three men. Known worldwide for their pioneering compositions and arrangements, Armstrong's, Ellington's, and Basie's popularity among white audiences would ultimately lay the foundation for the civil rights movement. Tye's new book is called The Jazz Men. Join Forum at 10 a.m. here on KQED.
The Bay Area heat advisory will be in effect until midnight Thursday night. The San Francisco Bay shoreline will become partly cloudy tonight with lows around 60. Wednesday will be sunny and hot. Expect Bay Area highs ranging from 71 at Ocean Beach to 98 in Santa Rosa tomorrow. The forecast high for Sacramento tomorrow is 104 degrees. The current temperature in Sacramento is 102. In Antioch right now, it's 96 degrees. Here in San Francisco, the current temperature is 78. Support for NPR comes from Easy Cater, committed to helping companies from nonprofits to the Fortune 500 find restaurants that cater meetings and events with online ordering and 24/7 live support. Learn more at easycater.com. From Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness and from the listeners of KQED Public Radio.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ezra Bernal is a pretty fantastic 10-year-old. His dad, Max, is a New York comedian, so Ezra knows a good punchline. When Max gets a shot at the big time, Ezra has thoughts.
I just got off the phone with Aunt Jane. Turns out Jimmy Kimmel wants me to be on his show in Los Angeles.
That's far.
When it comes down to it, though, Ezra's got his dad's back.
Where am I going to get my mojo from?
Mojo Mom.
That's right. Good.
Ezra is played by William Fitzgerald, and they both, actor and character, have autism. Max, played by Bobby Cannavale, hasn't quite figured out what that means for their life together. The movie is called Ezra. It's directed by Tony Goldwyn. And when I talked with producer Alex Plank and screenwriter Tony Spyridakis, Spyridakis told me the story comes from his own life with his son, Dimitri.
I didn't know what autism was, and so when the diagnosis came, he was only 4 years old. Things happened, you know, I was called to a birthday party where I dropped him off and they were playing musical chairs and he didn't get a chair. And that was the end of that party. I mean, I had to get called back to the house and take him out. And then the person at that party had suggested that I have him evaluated. So the whole journey of learning who my son was based on his autism, it was the dad, me, who really needed to be educated.
I'm hoping you can talk a little bit more about the on-set dynamics, Alex. As I understand it, everyone involved with the film took part in an autism education session. Can you talk a little bit about the things that you all did to make it an accessible set?
We looked at over 100 kids, many of whom had never acted before, and we watched tapes, and William's tape came in, and it was really good. And so we had a chemistry read, and I was just looking through my notes here, and and the first two lines say, he stims like me, and this is the guy. So, you know, we were really lucky to find William. But in terms of providing a good experience on set for him and creating a movie that I think was authentic and true to life and respectful of autistic people, and because really, when we see portrayals like this on film, those things really change the way we're treated in real life. You know, it's important to get these things right because there's so little portrayals of us, and generally they aren't portrayed by autistic actors. And then after that, I did a training right before we started filming, and all the department heads came, and I just went through all the sort of situations that could arise on set and how to be respectful of William, how to treat sensory issues right. There's just so many things that went into it. And I think that in reality, what happened was by doing that, it actually made a much more positive set environment for everyone.
I want to talk a little bit more about William Fitzgerald because, I mean, he is a first-time actor and this role is a big lift. He's funny and he's emotional. And in the film, we watch him go line for line with this incredible cast of industry veterans. I'm curious, for either of you, are there ways in which the script changed, in which the character changed once you found William and started working with him as Ezra?
There wasn't much that needed to be changed at all because he was the type of humor that he had, the type of speaking without a filter, that was what Dimitri was when he was 11. And it was what made the script sort of vibrant. And he was not as perhaps inappropriate as my son was, but he had instincts at certain points where he would improvise something and all of a sudden, it was just explosively funny. And then there was my Dimitri, right? Because that was where this whole thing started. It was the things that my son did that got him into trouble that I thought were extremely kind of brilliant and out of the box and spot on in some ways. And so what Tony Goldwyn did, which was so wonderful, is that he allowed William to be William. And that's what we all did. And that's everything that Alex represents. And that's everything that the film represents. It's not about changing or fixing your child. It's about letting him be or she be who they are.
And I would just add that one of the things that I really loved about him from the very start is he was just so passionate about his interests, right? Like, people who are autistic have special interests. I certainly do, and I will not shut up about them, and he's the same way. I was invited over to his house by his parents, and we spent about an hour watching YouTube videos about the history of the Civil War and world history. And he's just so passionate and filled with joy. And I think that you see that in the stimming, you know, because stimming is not just, oh, I'm overwhelmed. It's also, I'm excited about this thing I'm talking about. And, you know, I think that when we got on set, one of the things that I really pushed William to do was bring his own spin to things, because I think that's why his character resonates so much with people, because it's authentic and it taps into something that's true to who he is in a way and who we all are in a way.
One of the things that stuck with me in this film was the scene where Max is really just grappling with the choices he's made and how he can best show up for his son. And he says, I don't want him in his own world. I want him in this world. And I know a lot of people have written about that moment, but it really just has stayed with me. Can either of you say more about that?
This is sort of as much lightness and joy as there is in the film. That's the core pain. When you write from a really good, deep place, you are going to have to share stuff that's super private and super painful. And I think that line is everything I had to overcome. I wanted him in this world. Well, the journey for Max is, you can't have that, maybe. It's his world and your world.
And I think that's also something that we as autistic people go through, you know, in sort of a different way, in that we want to be like everyone else. And then my journey with that was that realizing that, like, I don't want to be like everyone else. I want to be like myself. And I think that this movie really explores that in a way that I think will make people think about, okay, well, maybe I shouldn't be trying so hard to be something I'm not.
For each of you, what do you hope that people will take away when they see this film?
For me, the biggest thing that I hope, and I'm already seeing people take away, is that there is finally a movie where I can see myself on screen. I've gotten so many messages from autistic people who watch the film who are in tears sometimes because they finally seen something where they feel represented and feel seen and heard and understood.
Yeah, that's what I love. I think that as much as it does that for the autism community, I also have to say that it's the parents of that community that's also so well represented in this film. The things that I get are very much from fathers who come up to me and just sort of cry. And we kind of hug each other. And it's just like hardly words need to be shared. But it's been an overwhelming amount of mail that I get from parents and family who are just so happy to see something represented where you can do the wrong thing, but the right thing can happen because of love.
Tony Spyridakis and Alex Plank, their new movie is Ezra in theaters now. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
President Biden has taken executive action to limit the number of migrants crossing into the U.S. from Mexico. That story is coming up next on All Things Considered after KQED News with Natalia Navarro and KQED Traffic, starting with better news about the drive on the peninsula. Here's Julie Depesch.
Yeah, it looks like they did take care of that minivan fire southbound 101 before Highway 85, so lanes should be opening up there. Very tough, though, back to Willow Road. And that brush fire in San Jose, that appears to be out now. It had blocked the Capitol Expressway on-ramp to northbound 101. Some new trouble in Fremont. There's a stall north 880 before Alvarado Boulevard. Look for that vehicle in the left lane. Julie Depesch for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from the California Academy of Sciences. Visitors can explore the wonders of California and see how big, bold, and biodiverse nature can be at California State of Nature, a new exhibit. Tickets at calacademy.org. And from the San Francisco SPCA, where adoption fees are waived on animals 5 months and older through June. Listeners can find a furry new friend at the Adoption Center at 250 Florida or sfspca.org. It's 5:30.
From KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. The Computer Voice Stress Analyzer, or CVSA, claims to analyze inaudible tremors in someone's voice to determine if they're telling the truth. According to reporting out today by the San Francisco Chronicle, it's used by at least 14 law enforcement agencies across California, in some cases during criminal investigations. The problem? It doesn't work. It's no more accurate at determining whether someone is lying than a flip of a coin. I'm joined now by Chronicle investigative reporter Susie Nielsen for more on this. Now let's start here. What exactly is this technology?
Yeah, so the Computer Voice Stress Analyzer is this tool used by law enforcement across the country that purportedly works by measuring inaudible changes to a person's speech pattern. So according to CVSA training manuals that we reviewed, a person's vocal cords are supposedly subject to these tremors that diminish when they're stressed. So when a voice pattern is plotted out on a graph and the person's voice sounds deceptive, it will look different than a non-deceptive person's when plotted on the same graph. But numerous studies, including studies funded by the U.S. Department of Justice, have found that the tool is no better than chance at detecting lies. And a study by these two professors in Sweden found that the supposed tremors the CVSA measures don't actually exist. They're not actually produced by the human voice, or at least no researchers have been able to detect those tremors.
For this story, you talked to a man who is actually suing the prison that he's incarcerated at for their use of this technology. Can you briefly tell us his story?
Yes. So I spoke at length with Raymond Whitehall, who is a 65-year-old man who has multiple disabilities, and he is incarcerated at Salinas Valley State Prison. And in 2017, Mr. Whitehall says that he was beaten up by several prison guards after he requested some medical help. And the prison guards claimed that Whitehall had attacked them with his cane, which he uses to walk. But when Whitehall asked the prison to reopen his case of abuse, the guards subjected him to this CVSA exam. And based on his answer to one question on that exam, where it indicated that he was deceptive, they closed out his abuse complaint.
What have the law enforcement agencies who use this CVSA had to say about why they're still using something that has been debunked?
One department I talked to, the Vacaville Police Department, they said that they believed there was research on both sides, some supporting the CVSA, some against it. As we write in our story, the research that purports to support the CVSA is not credible. We spoke with three departments in California who had confirmed that they used the technology in criminal investigations. And when we pressed further, they said that they didn't remember which criminal cases they used them in or refused to give additional details. Many departments use it in their hiring process for officers, and so they say, because it's not part of the criminal investigation process, it's okay. We did review law enforcement forums where police who are denied a job because of their findings on this test are really frustrated because they know that the tool doesn't work. And so, yeah, there are plenty of concerns. But the CDCR, to their credit, when we kept asking them about why they use this tool, they ended up telling us that they were going to move forward to end the use of the tool across the prison system.
So what's next for Mr. Whitehall's lawsuit?
Mr. Whitehall is currently being represented by some pro bono attorneys, and their lawsuit is scheduled to go to trial in August.
Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Susie Nielsen, an investigative reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'm Natalia Navarro. This is KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for KQED comes from the Exploratorium. Extraordinary is a new exhibition of incredible art made from shoes, light bulbs, Lego, and more. Opens June 13th at Pier 15. Tickets at exploratorium.edu/extra. And from visitorscoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com. Support for NPR comes from Spiegel and Grau, publisher of Cheaper, Faster, Better, How We'll Win the Climate War by climate activist and investor Tom Steyer, offering answers and optimism in the fight against climate change, available at bookstores everywhere. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR.
From NPR News, I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Biden took sweeping executive action today aimed at cracking down on illegal crossings at the southern border.
I've come here today to do what the Republicans in Congress refuse to do, take the necessary steps to secure our border.
The new steps will allow Biden to shut the border to asylum seekers when there are surges in numbers of people trying to get across. Now, this comes just a couple of weeks before his first debate with former President Trump. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is covering the presidential campaign. He is here with us now to talk about the politics of all this. Hey, Franco.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, tell me more. This executive order, how does it work in a nutshell?
I mean, this is a move that's long been expected. And what it'll mean is that when there are 2,500 people a day trying to cross the border unlawfully, the system effectively will shut down. And that's a threshold that they're already seeing, so the new restrictions are expected to start right away. And it won't reopen until the daily numbers fall below 1,500.
And just to point out, this is very similar to what the bipartisan group of senators were trying to get done earlier this year.
That's right. I mean, Republicans pulled out of that bipartisan agreement that would have taken many of the similar steps. And polls do show that Americans see this issue as one of the biggest problems of the day. And most Americans actually don't approve of the way that Biden is handling the border. The Biden administration, though, says that they had no choice to do this after the Republicans backed out of that deal. And here's Biden again, actually.
So today, I'm moving past Republican obstruction and using the executive authorities available to me as president to do what I can on my own to address the border.
Okay, I want to note we're saying Republicans backed out of that deal. That was largely led by Trump, who undercut that previous deal because of politics, which prompts me to ask you, how much of Biden's motivations here are political?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And I mean, I think today what really struck me is how Biden jumped right into the politics of this and blamed Republicans for what he described as a border crisis. I mean, we are entering crunch time for the election. The first debate is weeks away. Early voting starts in September. I mean, this is one of Biden's biggest political vulnerabilities. And it's really not just Republicans attacking him. I mean, when he made that announcement in the East Room of the White House, he was surrounded by mayors and governors, including some Democrats who have been raising concerns and pushing him to get tougher on the border.
Yeah. So who is he trying to reach with this message?
I mean, this is an issue that's no longer just a concern for border states. I mean, I kind of noted that this is a concern in cities and towns, hundreds of miles from the border, including in the important battleground states that are going to decide this election. I spoke with Ben Tolchin, a Democratic pollster. He says voters are paying attention right now.
President Biden has a real tough fight for re-election on his hands, and he's got to convince voters in swing states that he's taking border security seriously. If you think about the battleground states of Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, or Nevada and Arizona, immigration and border security matters.
And he pointed out that this is a particular concern among suburban voters in those states for people who are concerned about crime and border security.
Let me ask you about reaction to this executive order. What's the Trump campaign saying?
The Trump campaign's calling it toothless. They're saying Trump is much tougher. They're pointing to some of the exceptions in the measures, such as for unaccompanied minors. And there are some real challenges for Biden, such as the lack of resources at the border. That said, these are some of the toughest measures by a Democratic administration.
And briefly, what about reaction from immigration groups, advocacy groups?
I mean, Biden is getting attacked from both sides. I mean, these are plans that are kind of out of Trump's playbook. Trump tried to use this same authority, and they were sued by the ACLU. And the ACLU told me that they plan to sue again.
NPR's Franco Ordonez reporting from the White House. Thank you.
Thank you.
The songwriter and producer known as The Dream is behind some of the biggest chart toppers of our time. He frequently collaborates with artists like Beyoncé, Rihanna, and Mariah Carey. Well, today, one of his former protégés filed a lawsuit accusing him of violent abuse while he promised to make her a star. We'll note that this report from NPR culture correspondent Anastasia Tsiolkas includes descriptions of physical and sexual assault over the next few minutes. Hi, Anastasia.
Hi there, Ari.
The Dream is really well known in R&B music, less so in the public eye. For folks who are not familiar with him, why is he so important?
Well, he's a singer, songwriter, and producer. More than anything, The Dream's a major hit maker. Beyoncé, for example, has collaborated with him on every one of her albums since 2008. He's a songwriter and producer on some of her big hits, including Single Ladies and Break My Soul, and he's won 8 Grammy Awards. In this lawsuit, though, the woman, Shahnaz Mangro, alleges The Dream promised to make her just as big as Beyoncé and another of his collaborators, Rihanna. And I'll note he's being sued under his legal name, which he recently changed from Terrius Nash to Terrius Castile Diamant.
Can you tell us more about the lawsuit, the woman who filed it, and what's alleged?
Sure. She is a singer and songwriter from the Netherlands. She filed the suit in California in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles. And she alleges while The Dream was making extravagant promises about stardom, he pressured her for sex almost immediately. And in the suit, she says, he told her sex with him was, quote, part of the process. And so she's accusing him of raping her, violently assaulting her on multiple occasions, including strangling her, forcing her to drink alcohol, and psychologically manipulating her. She alleges he forced her to tell him where she was at all times, and that he allegedly made a video of one of their sexual encounters and then threatened to show it to other people. And she says he told her all the while that this was the path to a huge career.
When does she say this happened?
So she says one of his associates reached out to her in very late 2014 and that she met him in person in January 2015, and she alleges the abuse began almost immediately and continued for months. So this is like a decade ago, right? But her lawsuit cites California's Sexual Abuse and Cover-Up Accountability Act, which specifically allows people to file suits on sexual assault accusations even if the statute of limitations has expired on the alleged incidents.
Has there been any response from The Dream or his lawyers?
Not to NPR, no, though, of course, we've asked for comment. But a spokesperson of his told The New York Times in a statement, quote, these claims are untrue and defamatory, and that, quote, I am deeply offended and saddened by these accusations. And I should point out that Mangro's suit is also against the record label Epic Records, which is part of Sony Music Entertainment. Mangro says they knew about but ignored the abuse. And she's also suing a company co-owned by The Dream. We haven't heard back from either Epic Records or The Dream's representative. So I think it's going to take a while to see how this all plays out.
All right. That is NPR's Anastasia Tsiolkas. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you for having me, Ari.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
New Mexico is one of the last states to hold a presidential primary this year. So today, with the nominees for both major parties essentially locked up, voters in the land of enchantment have turned their focus farther down the ballot. Reporting from Albuquerque, we are joined by NPR politics reporter Ben Giles. Hey, Ben.
Hey there.
All right, so take us way down the ballot. What races are people there in New Mexico watching today?
Well, most of the action today is at the legislative and local levels. Every seat in the State House and Senate is up for grabs this year. I spoke with voters in Albuquerque and in southern New Mexico. Republicans and Democrats alike, they all say there's hope in a strategy to get voters engaged early to ensure they stay engaged come November. For instance, Republicans in Bernalillo County, that's home to Democratic-leaning Albuquerque, they were abuzz because they have contested GOP primaries for some House and Senate races at the legislative level. That's a first for them. In the past, they say it's been a struggle to get Republicans to run at all in some of those races, but those races are attracting the attention of Republican voters, and they hope that attention will stick.
This is interesting because we hear a lot about candidates down the ballot riding the coattails of presidential contenders. You are saying there's hope that maybe enthusiasm for these down ballot races will trickle up?
That's right. And that hope is also on the Democratic side as well. I spent some time this weekend in Las Cruces where volunteers were knocking on doors for Congressman Gabe Vasquez in southern New Mexico. Vasquez narrowly defeated former Representative Yvette Harrell in 2022. Their rematch this fall is garnering a lot of attention. Now, no one's running against Vasquez for the Democratic nomination, but he and his volunteers, like Rita Treviz, said it was still important to start engaging voters now, even in uncontested races, rather than wait until November. And Treviz had a message for Democrats who might be lacking in enthusiasm, especially at the top of the ticket.
And I hope people understand that instead of pout, you know? Somebody said, just get on the bus. It may not take you exactly to the Garden of Eden, but if it gets you closer to there, take the bus. And Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are a limo for me.
Clearly, yeah. She's a big supporter of the Democratic presidential ticket, but she's also discouraged by a lack of enthusiasm, even among some strong Democrats. I spoke with another young Vasquez volunteer who said he cast an uncommitted vote in the Democratic primary.
I'm tempted to ask you more about limos in the Garden of Eden, but instead I will ask, where does that leave Trump? I mean, if young voters in New Mexico are dissatisfied with Biden, might Trump be trying to pick them up?
Sure, but it's not necessarily a clean trade. We are seeing a lot of that at the national level, these so-called double haters who view both Biden and Trump unfavorably. Daphne Orner is the vice chair of the Bernalillo County Republicans. I asked her if GOP messaging is resonating with young voters there. She said yes, particularly in the wake of Trump's criminal conviction last week.
When the verdict came down on Trump, they're saying, okay, I've had enough now. But to get them active and doing anything, the majority of our party is kind of what you see in this room. We're no spring chickens.
And in that room, Daphne was referring to the county GOP headquarters. It was full of a handful of mostly older volunteers. So it's maybe not picking up steam, but they're hoping it will. There's definitely an effort to use the Trump conviction to activate a new generation of Republican voters here.
That is NPR's Ben Giles reporting from Albuquerque. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The KQED News Quiz is next, and then stay tuned for Political Breakdown. But first, let's get your traffic update starting in Fremont. Here's Julie Deppish.
And that's where somebody ran out of gas on North 880 before Alvarado Boulevard. That's blocking the left lane, causing that backup to Thornton Avenue. Be on the lookout at Martinez Highway 4 westbound after Alhambra. Someone lost a barbecue grill. It's in the right lane. And metering lights are on the Bay Bridge Toll Plaza. It hit the brakes around the island and stays very slow to the 101 interchange. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Julie will have another update in 10 minutes. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity. With their Wi-Fi Boost Pod, in-home wall-to-wall Wi-Fi offers coverage throughout the home. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. It's now time for the KQED News Quiz Question of the Day, sponsored by Canyon Ranch Woodside. Today's question is, on Morning Edition today, two archivists discussed their efforts to preserve decades of recordings from a local LGBT radio show that documented the complexities of gay life in which Texas city? Submit your answers at kqed.org/radio news quiz for a chance to enter to win a two-night stay at Canyon Ranch Woodside.
These days, rapper Fat Joe isn't just known for his music. He's also a fierce advocate for affordable health care. Our series, We the Voters, continues on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition airs from 2 until 9 here on KQED. And later this week on Forum, driverless cars. Are they exciting, annoying, dangerous, all of the above? We'll talk with the experts and hear from you. That's later this week on Forum, weekday mornings from 9 to 11 with an evening repeat from 8 to 10 here on KQED Public Radio.
It's KQED News. I'm Natalia Navarro. Eleni Kounalakis is the first woman elected lieutenant governor in California, and now she's aiming for the top rung, running for governor in 2026 after Gavin Newsom is termed out. On today's political breakdown, host Scott Schaefer is joined by Kounalakis to talk about the new abortion super PAC she launched and what she'd like to do as governor.
Let me begin with this super PAC that you recently launched. It's called Californians for Choice, and it's aimed at mobilizing pro-abortion rights voters, especially, I guess, in Arizona and Nevada. What are the goals?
Well, the goal is, and first of all, let me just say, this really is an incredibly important issue for voters going into November. We have seen the deterioration of women's rights. 50 years of reproductive rights were wiped away 2 years ago.
By the Dobbs decision.
By the Dobbs decision, and voters really care. And so as I've traveled the state recently, going into November and the fight against Trump coming back and all that that means, the potential for a nationwide abortion ban, people say to me, you know, Eleni, I get the emails. They ask me for $25. I'm willing to help, but I want to do more. What else can I do? And so what this Californians for Choice does is we are reaching people, voters, volunteers across the state, getting them to sign up to participate in phone banking and text banking, going if they can to some of the tight congressional districts to volunteer, and as you noted, going to a couple of these battleground states where being on the ground campaigning for Democratic pro-choice candidates, including Biden-Harris, will make the big difference.
So you're really reaching out to Californians, getting them to phone bank into Arizona and Nevada and maybe walking precincts or doing something if they can go there. Is that what that is?
That's right. Right now, I'm the highest ranking woman in elected office in our state, and I feel like it is my responsibility to stand up and to organize other like-minded people for whom women's reproductive choice and the ability to control our bodies is really important. And get out there and talk to other voters who care about it so we can get out the vote and make a difference in this election.
Why focus on other states? I mean, you are the lieutenant governor of California. We do have some really very competitive congressional races here, four or five that are toss-ups where the Republican incumbents are targeted by the Democrats. Why go outside the state?
You know, when I was very young, I was a volunteer in politics, and I was a young Democrat. Again, I was a businesswoman, but I did these things because it was, you know, part of how I was raised to be involved. And walking precincts, communicating with voters one-on-one, it's really, really important. Voters trust other voters. And so I just know how important this is, and I really believe that by example, in my own volunteerism, I could reach other voters to join me and do the same.
Sounds a little bit, maybe a lot, like Governor Newsom's campaign for democracy, where he's going out raising money with a super PAC to influence folks and to really to speak out and call out some of the policies that are happening in these states, whether it's anti-LGBTQ or guns or whatever it might be.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that California can do a lot in mobilizing voters and in bringing resources to these campaigns. And I think the fact that a couple hundred thousand voters in swing states are going to determine the way that 39 million people live here in California through the election of the next president, I think people are very aware of this and want to be involved and do their part.
California has sort of carved out for itself the position of being almost a sanctuary for women seeking abortions or reproductive services that they can't get in states like Arizona or Texas. Do you see that as, you know, problematic at all? I mean, should California taxpayers, for example, be paying for travel for women who, you know, can't get what they need in other states?
Well, I think that the amount of funds that have been budgeted for that sort of thing has been relatively, you know, it's manageable. The bigger issue to me as someone who represented the United States overseas is this idea that we are put in a position where we have to offer sanctuary to other American women. We've never been in a situation like this before, but it is necessary, Scott, because women are dying in these red states that have put these abortion bans in place. Doctors won't touch women with emergency needs for abortions, even, you know, if it's clear that they're getting sicker and sicker because they're afraid that they're going to get sued. This is an emergency situation, and if California needs to be a sanctuary, then that's what we're going to do.
Do you think that, as many do, that these rights are safe in California, no matter who the president is, because, you know, voters recently enshrined abortion rights in the Constitution and so on? Are there things that you are worried about that could happen in spite of all the laws and the policies and the political environment here in California?
Well, I'll tell you, I worked really hard on Proposition 1. I brought Hillary Clinton out to California to campaign.
That was the $6.3 billion bond measure recently on the ballot.
No, the change, no.
Different Prop
Proposition 1 of 2 years ago was changing the California Constitution to enshrine the right to contraception and abortion in our state. We did a big public media campaign at Planned Parenthood, and we did enshrine those rights in the California Constitution. I just think that we all know that we are a subnational government. We are a state in the United States. If Donald Trump is reelected with the support of all of these radical MAGA, you know, anti-choice people, and is beholden to them, as he will be if that nightmare scenario were to happen again, and we don't have a backstop in the Congress, yes, they can pass a national abortion ban, and it will impact us, and we can fight it in the courts for a long time because we've enshrined this right in our Constitution. But ultimately, the earlier that we push back against this and stop this through the ballot box, the better it's going to be for all of us.
And key to that, from your perspective, I assume, is flipping some of these red congressional seats in California, four or five of them, to blue.
That's correct. And so we're watching from afar, you know, what the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is doing, where they're prioritizing the races. You know, it's public information, what they think are the closest races. And that's where we are going to take all of our volunteers. By the way, Scott, Californians for Choice already has 4,000 volunteers signed up just since we started. And so we will be helping to target the energy and the efforts of our volunteers to help win those close congressional districts so that we can protect choice here in California and of course in the other states where it's still legal.
Yeah, and just quickly, I mean, it's ironic. Democrats used to be sort of on the defense about abortion, and now they're very much on the offensive now that it's problematic as an issue for supporters.
You know, as a woman, I can tell you, I think it's important that we say the word because it's a medical procedure. And it's a medical procedure that has been a right for women and one that, as we know, has been important in saving women's lives in many cases.
That was California Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis talking with KQED's Scott Schaefer. You can hear the rest of their conversation on the Political Breakdown podcast. I'm Natalia Navarro. This is KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From your part-time controller, U.S.-based staff helping nonprofits with their accounting, from bookkeeping to financial reporting and analysis to CFO services, YPTC.com/NPR. From the NPR Wine Club, where members can explore wines from around the world, and every purchase supports NPR's high-quality journalism, available to adults 21 or older, nprwineclub.org, and from the listeners of KQED. In your KQED traffic update at 5:59.